Welcome to the Tom Nelson Podcast. I have Denis DiBernardi here. Denis, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Right. So I'm, it's a long story, but I'm an engineer by train background with a dual degree in management. And I've spent the better part of my career doing what engineers and managers do, and with a distant eye on the environment, following the media and so forth. And when COVID started, really, I decided that, okay, enough of this, and let's get into environmental issues, basically. And I had concerns at the time because I had been following the 2008 meltdown, financial crisis, from pretty closely, and so I was expecting a complete meltdown of the financial system when it started, and I had no idea when, but I basically certain that it was looming, and so I figured, well, might as well get into farming, because that way at least you have something to eat, and plus there were still these environmental concerns in my mind, and so I got into farming at the time. And as I did, I was learning about digging deeper into environmental issues and learning all sorts of things about the what the environmental movement was actually up to in the background, which had never really concerned me as an engineer, end user of the stuff. But now that I was looking deeper into the topic, it felt a bit weird, and eventually I decided to get involved with it, and so that's how we end up in this conversation. I think one of the movies that triggered me most was do you remember that Michael Moore movie, Planet of the Humans? The campaign against it had shocked me at the time. You remember like the negative campaign? And
yeah, I do.
And that's when I started to look deeper. That's really like it was a complete trigger for me. I picked up on the negative press. I did not agree with it. The movie had struck me as balanced overall, and you know, putting good arguments forward, like this is not right. Like all of this mining is completely absurd, right? All of this industrialized process is completely absurd as well. Mining for those in the audience who are not too familiar, like, it creates phenomenal amounts of mining waste, because you know, like you dig deep and you dig compressed rock, so the volume of waste that comes out is actually more, because you need to pulverize it, and so that decompresses all of the rocks and so forth. So like it's a humongous amount of mining waste, which is at times toxic. It's really, really not nice to live near a mine or work in one, for that matter. And the science, that's also the time when I started picking up on the science, because they were arguing, like, the science says, but then when you start reading the actual signature of carbon signature of green tech, you begin to realize that there's a whole bunch of things that are completely missing, such as the health ramifications for the nearby population. It's not accounted for ever. All of the side effects, the context of mining really is completely absent, and of the waste, the waste streams, the carbon signature stops at the landfill, essentially. And what happens after is we don't know. Plus all of the logistics problems, like it's just such a pointless thing. And so that prompted me to get into to look deeper into resilience. And at the time I was already into permaculture, so it was a bit second nature to dive deeper and continue learning how to grow food. And that led me to stumble upon green colonialism. Now, green colonialism is not well known in the West, but it's actually a thing. Have you ever had a guest on this that discussed this topic?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so there are conservancies like the WWF or the nature conservancies. They are in charge of saving nature, right? And the way they save nature is they go to places like Africa or South Asia or Latin America, and they say, oh, this is a very lovely area and we need to save it. We need to protect it. Now, sometimes they work a bit with the locals and they get the locals involved and they involve the locals in protecting the area and helping them manage it properly and entertaining the tourists, which is not fantastic when the tourist revenue stream turns off, because they basically create a tourist park. So conservancies are very much about hunting reserves for the very rich, like those who like to kill elephants, and safari tours for the rest of us. And in Africa, they have these militarized forces, militarized park guards, and they basically kick the locals out. So they steal their land, they steal a lot of land that way. The Maasai peoples in Tanzania are making some headlines from time to time. People who are interested in the topic would check out Survival International, which is at the front of that of these battles. They usually have some very, very good information. And so what justifies all of that is carbon accounting. So it's basically the other side of this carbon signature nonsense of the green tech thing. You have these carbon stocks that you justify protecting, right? And so you get paid to protect them. And there are other carbon stocks, you get paid to grow trees on it, which is another shenanigan where you basically, it's usually commercial plantations, so like palm oil, rubber, teak, that type of thing. So what they do for that, they steal land from indigenous peoples, plains, grasslands, which usually don't have enough water to sustain a forest, to support a forest, and then they grow trees on top, which obviously is a dismal failure very frequently. Like it's really shambles. And for that, the Chris Lang is a good source to check out for those who are interested. It's a real shenanigan. Like this carbon accounting thing is really bizarre when you think about it. The carbon accounting also allows to justify things like biomass energy, right? And which is also covered inside the Planet of the Human movie, right? He actually starts with that. And so the way they justify burning biomass is also through carbon finance. You have these stocks of carbon, and from a year to the next, as you grow trees and you harvest trees, on average, it stays the same, right? And so because you're replanting the trees, you're not going to count the land use change, which is the key. It's not a land use change. Like in their accounting system, the field tree stumps is a forest because it's going to get replanted soon. Which makes sense, but you know. And which is like, it's completely bizarre. And so like the deeper I dug into this and basically the less of it made sense. And it grew on me one day that I wanted to fight from, you know, from the inside. And so that's when I joined the, I latched onto really a few environmental groups. Now I latched onto several of them. It's like which ones doesn't really matter, but it quickly dawned on me that I was wasting my time. But I stuck on to actually, you know, see what was going on. It's awkward. You know, there's this document that you see circulate from time to time where like CIA organizes disorganizes really opposition groups on the inside by asking, you know, like slowing everything down, making meetings inefficient and things like that, like wasting time on every possible thing. It's exactly that. It's exactly that, meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting. It's just, it's nowhere. And I sat inside a meeting. It was I've sat as an observer. There was this representative of the European industry who was, you know, explaining, yeah, but we actually need fossil fuels. Like, you know, like we can't function without them. Like, I get that we need to reduce them, but what are we supposed to do with it? And the expert says, yeah, but you need to reduce them. And like, and that was a whole meeting, like for it lasts for an hour. It's like pure waste of time. Nothing constructive. Another thing is they're driven by attention metrics, which is very surprising. And there's this, I think he's Belgian, Le Biais Vert. He made this short movie, 10 Minutes, Anita, which featured like this Greta type figure who is completely zoned out and bored by what her activism. It's a short movie. There's this one scene inside that I have seen this before, and it's imagine a scene where she goes into this meeting, and there's these marketers like, and we have this amount of views and this amount of followers and this amount of extra media attention. And it's exactly that. And I have literally sat through a meeting where it was that. And at the end, you had the guy who was like the activist leader, and like, now I need you to tweet this using that specific hashtag. And yes, now we have 500 of them, and like, let's make it trend. And like, exactly that. Now, I think in their defense, I do think that part of that is because of the way they are funded, and that their funders are driving them using metrics and media attention metrics of the of that nature. So there might be something in that area, but at any rate, it's not effective. I think a more general remark that we can say is that so like clearly they're controlled opposition, and with the benefit of hindsight, I would say that any group that is about disempowering people is controlled opposition, right? Any activity that creates like entitled frustration really is controlled opposition, but inaction, promoting inaction. And I think that actually, like when you look at it, both sides of the narrative are controlled opposition in reality, I think, because even on our side of the debate, where we're like, no, the science is wrong, it does not promote action. It does not promote getting out of the conundrum that we're in, where you have two groups fighting one another. There's no constructive, let's solve this type of thing going on, which is unfortunate. I think some of them might be by design, with the benefit of hindsight, like especially fossil fuel interests, but quite a few others, like, you know, stuck in the two-party paradigm, type of situation where you know it's left thing and we're on the right thing, but when actually both sides are, to my mind, controlled by the same puppeteers in the background. It's the wrong kind of green. Corey Morningstar's work would be a great place to look for that type of information. She does a fantastic job at documenting this. Paul Tudenek as well. He is Winter Oak on Twitter, Winter Oak Press. So, okay. Two fantastic sources for that.
I do have a question here. I want to make sure I want to make sure I understand you on the controlled opposition. Like for Extinction Rebellion, for example, you think they're controlled opposition? Controlled by who? Who's controlling them? Yeah.
They're funded by conservancy. Extinction Rebellion, as I recollect, they are, if memory serves me well, they are controlled control. Their leadership is has have ties to Chatham House, which is like a globalist think tank in London, like very, very private club. You'd need to double check on Cory Morningstar's website for that. She's a very good job at exposing them. All of them. The conservancies are part of the problem, really. They are like completely bought and paid for by billionaire philanthropies. They are philanthropies, really, at the service of billionaires. The conservancies, what they do besides kicking locals out is they develop the land, really. And the leadership of the conservancies, for good sources of for that, you'd want to check out the work of Stephen Corey. He was the former CEO of Survival International. And Mordecai Ogada, who also does a fantastic job as I've mentioned this. Basically, like, they open mines, really. They kick the locals out to protect nature. But this area over there, there's some mining to do to save the planet by making green tech, stuff like that. So we're going to exploit that part, right? But the rest will protect. And then, you know, there's a forest, so we need to clear the trees. And the leadership, we always talk about the revolving doors with politics, but the revolving doors also exist between corporations and big conservancies and big NGOs. It's a very small club at the top of all these organizations. So, yeah. Does that answer your question?
It does. It brings up another question. Can you describe in a little more detail what you mean by the revolving doors? Is it where you do something for one organization with the idea you're going to be rewarded when you move to a different one? What is the idea of the revolving doors?
I think they're all, it's, I've come to understand this as a class corruption, if you will, to borrow Marx's term. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And it's perfectly normal. Like when you're in a business circle, like I have been in business circles, like you, it's normal to help each other out, right? Mm-hmm. Like you do someone a favor and then you can ask a favor from someone else, from that person in the future or not. Maybe you give a favor to someone else as a group. And as a group, they scratch each other's back, which is good natured, really. Like you go to the same schools, you attend the same Ivy League schools, you live in the same areas, like you work as a class. I still struggle, even though like the evidence is obvious and to our faces nowadays, but I still struggle to accept the idea that there's like some secretive organization in the background. Like I've been a manager. It's very hard to completely control an organization from the top down. I think there's always a degree of leeway and taking advantage of things for personal gain at every step along the way, or simply to improve things which are not right. So I still struggle to believe in like wholesale conspiracy, but the idea that as a group, a bunch of people with shared interests and shared financial interests really help each other out as they go from one organization to another, even if it looks benign, and it's not benign, but even if it looks benign, it's there. It's there. One example I cite in my book is the use of state resources. In the first chapter of my book, I mentioned that, where you have this biomass company, which is destroying forests really in the South Carolina area, and throughout the South really of the United States, and they just raise forests. That's what they do, and they don't raise the forest themselves. They collect the forestry waste, and they make wood pellets. And for that, they so it's a polluting activity that creates all sorts of sawdust, which is not very healthy for the locals and or the workers for that matter. And they collect all sorts of subsidies, and these subsidies are, you know, like normal, right? That's how capitalism works. You get the state to sponsor your activity, and you take the check, right? And but all these leaders, they're part of the same group. So I think really it's, class corruption is the way to look at it, more than individual corruption.
So you wrote a book called A Natural Language. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you came to write it?
That's such a good question, actually. There's something that I had been going on in my mind since early adulthood on the nature of cognition, which I wanted to put in writing one day. And it that's why the title of the book. The topic of the book is more environmental issues. It was in part because I wanted to write a book to denounce what I had found on environmental issues. And like, it could feel a bit vain at the time, but many people, many people have already documented everything I write. So like, it's just not a book that says the same thing. But at the same time, I was also finding solutions as I was learning about agroecology and how to grow food. And so that's how the book came about. And I think the tipping point was a challenge. There was one activist leader who challenged me one day, like I dumped it into a meeting, like, I think the science is wrong. I don't think it's about fossil fuel, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. And he was like, look, like, the science is the science, like, write a book if you feel differently. And so I did. He hasn't read it, by the way.
Okay. All right.
He doesn't answer my email. And so, yeah. Actual opposition, to get back on topic, is, to my mind, about empowering. It's about action. It's about giving others the tools they need to take action to, you know, address, to resolve the fear that they have. Now, what that could look like for activists, like for green activists, is so reducing fossil fuel, right? They're always, always, always talking about reducing fossil fuels. And it seems to me that, and it seemed to me at the time, like that's part of why I joined activist groups, is to, you know, permaculture and all. And one of the first things that you learn is like the importance of food in your energy consumption. And so grow food, because that's how you reduce your energy consumption and you can live more sustainably. And I was like, yeah, just promote that, promote growing food, simple, like problem solved, right? And it makes sense, because when you look at your energy, like at the energy signature of developing countries, like it's really a Rube Goldberg machine of sorts. Like the amount of effort that goes into getting a consumer to purchase a food item off the shelf of a supermarket is phenomenal. Like, and even the permaculture videos that try to capture this do not capture the full extent of the absurdity. Like, you have an entire supply chain to feed into instead of having a shovel, right? And that entire supply chain also requires that you have a military and a police force to defend and surveil that supply chain, because no one wants to live near a mine, right? So, and no one wants to let go of their land to create a mine. So you need to boot the locals out, which is what conservancies are doing in Africa. Then you need the army or park guards to secure that mine, and so on and so forth. And no one wants to live near a trash incinerator downstream. So you also need police to, because else the locals would just like, hello, we don't need this. We don't want this thing here. Trash, by the way, is a very good proxy of energy use. If you look at the amount, if you look inside of your trash, you have a good proxy of what the energy signature of the items that you're purchasing is. And the, you need to do this all the way down the supply chain, right? And food is everywhere. The signature of food is absolutely everywhere. Like, look into things like plastic culture, the fertilizers, the machinery, the tractors, the processing, refrigeration, transportation, packaging, all of it. Like, all of that goes into food, right? And it's a small signature every single time, but it's day after day after day after day after day after day after day. It's like a yacht with a teak deck, huge energy signature, but you do it once. Food every single day. And food also has imperialist ramifications that they really do matter. Like after World War II, we set up the World Trade Organization, right? Yep. And one of the rules of the World Trade Organization is that you cannot have food subsidies unless they were already in place when you joined. And so Europe and the United States have food subsidies for that reason. And every other country does not.
I did not know that.
Uh-huh. And so what happens then is that this the Western food sector puts local farmers in places like Africa out of business. And then the World Bank kicks in. And now the function of the World Bank is to take communities out of subsistence farming, which is to say autonomous, like they have food sovereignty, and to instead fund modern agricultural plantations and mining and that type of thing. And so what they end up doing, like the combination of the two, is that you take subsistence farmers who were making a living before the WTO, before independence and the WTO, and then they get replaced by corporations that set up teak plantations or palmer plantations all over the place, which are funded by carbon credits. It's a nice, well, it's well-oiled cogs, to put it that way, and it's part of a complete system. And then the migrants, they go to cities or they go to the United States or Europe. The poor farmers who have nothing to do because they lost their land and everything. So it's like, yeah. It's not good. And so anyway, it seemed to me at the time that promoting gardening and urban farming would be the right thing to do. And it's worth noting in passing how much more productive a garden is than a agricultural field. Like Western agriculture with machinery is one of the least efficient things that you can do. Like you have like a cornfield with corn after corn after corn after corn after corn. Whereas in a garden, you can stack things, you can succession plant all over the place. You can have seedlings that are ready to go when you take a plant out. Like, it's phenomenally more productive as a food system. In the aftermath, after the USSR fell, Cuba used to depend on it for its food supply, for its grains. And overnight that ceased. And so what they ended up doing is create all sorts of urban farms. And so they have a very, very strong gardening culture, urban gardening culture in Cuba. And they have yields on the order of 20 kilos per square meter of garden bed, which is huge. It's really, really huge. And when you're in a good climate, like the one that I am at the moment, you like in a 100 square meter garden, you can get 400 kilos of food easily. By stacking things, by planting in three dimensions, by succession planting all over the place. Uh, it, yeah, it, it's really that much more productive. And so that was part of the things that I wanted to promote as well, is like more gardening culture. Korea style is another interesting one. They eat a lot more fruit, a lot more vegetables and fruits as well than Westerners. And so besides being a healthier diet, it's also a fairly bit more productive. They have maybe 5-10 times more productive per unit of surface. So I'm just pulling a number out of my ass here, but it's a lot more. It's like really, really a lot more. Russia also. Russia, when the USSR fell, before that as well, but especially after the USSR fell, they could not afford to feed themselves. So they have this huge dacha culture. And they all have this this weekend house of sorts, which my wife is Hungarian. We lived there for a while. That culture is also present in Hungary to a large degree. So everyone has a small garden outside the city where they go to during the weekend, and they grow food like there's no tomorrow, and which is really, really nice, because then you get fresh food all year during the growing season anyway. And if you do it right, you can get food all year round, really, including in places like Hungary or Russia, like with the underground greenhouse. So yeah, and one question that is like, what do the farmers do in that case? And the farmers can of course focus on other yields, like regenerative grazing, so grass-fed meat basically. As well as other yields like fibers, including hemp in particular. Hemp is really, really useful product for all sorts of things. You make paper using it, lots of paper, much better yields than with forests, than with wood. Like it's criminal that we don't make paper using hemp. Hemp is fantastic. Anyway, so that was that. Another big item. Energy use item that I is heat, right? So you heat your home, you need heat to cook, you need heat for and for that permaculture, like introduced, I had no idea these things existed until I learned permaculture. It's a rocket mass heater. So for those in the audience who are not familiar, you want to look up a rocket stove, which works on the same principle as the Dakota fire pit. And so it's like you have a heat riser. And you put the wood at the bottom, and because heat rises, this creates an air draft, which creates complete combustion. And what you do with the rocket mass heater is that you basically put a barrel or some kind of container over it, and then you pipe the heat inside a mass of stone, and that stores the heat. And this allows to heat a home, so not with the fire itself, but with the stored heat inside the mass. And so that means that you can heat your home with stickwood from the garden, from garden prunings and from forestry waste and things like that. When we were in Hungary, we would take the car every several days, and we would fill the trunk with stickwood that we pick up in nearby forests, and we kept ourselves warm that way. So it's really, really, really efficient as a way to get heat. You can also use it for other things like heating water or cooking. You can cook on the barrel if you need to. It's like I'm mentioning this because like there's going to be fuel shortages soon in Europe. Like if you haven't invested in a rocket mass heater yet for your home, now is a good time. Still, you just need some bricks. Okay. That stores the heat, and that's really key. Like storing that heat is such a, like the cat loves it.
Okay, very good.
By the way, the same principle as the rocket mass heater could be used to soak up a smokestack. I'm fairly sure. So as everyone in the audience will surely know, plants love carbon dioxide, and you could take the smokestack, the industrial one, like take the chimney and pipe it through like a drip irrigation system of sorts. You could imagine doing that, right? You take the heat out, store it somewhere, make hot water, whatever, do something with it. And the polluting smokestack, then you send that into a hemp field. And I would take the bet that the hemp would know what to do with the carbon dioxide and some water.
Okay.
Now, hemp is interesting because it soaks up toxins, all sorts of toxins. Tobacco is another one that does that, but hemp is like a phenomenal grower. And so we could also depollute the areas, depollute the smokestacks that way, quite possibly. I'd love to do the experiment if there's like some billionaire funders, whoever watched this, like I'd love to do that experiment, or someone who, a researcher who would like to try that out, because that would actually absorb a big chunk, I think, of the industrial smokestacks, and we could make use of it. There's probably a business case I think, as well, where you basically send that to farmers and they grow whatever they need with it. I don't think food, because of the toxins, but things like fiber, why not? The more general point of permaculture is to highlight holistic management, really. And so that revolves around two key ideas, which both of which help reduce energy use. One is to design around more than one function. Everything needs to be about more than one thing, ideally. It's not always possible, but ideally you strive to design your system that way. So it's not just about producing a flame. You also collect the heat, make use of it, pipe it through whatever, like more than one thing. And the other is about designing around minimal input and minimal waste rather than optimized output. And this is an amazing idea once you get used to it. Like it's like you take take meat, right? So you eat meat and you can trash the meat at the end, or you can feed it to your dog, or you can feed it, you can put it into a bucket, and that the bugs will then eat it, and then that's chicken feed, healthy proteins for the chickens. Like everything can be reused, and you want to design around reusing things as much as possible, and finding alternative uses so that you do not end up with waste. If you have waste at some point, you did something wrong, really. And we as a society produce a lot of waste, and so yeah, permaculture. And so that's nice and all, but it would not eliminate the carbon hockey stick, which is the main theme of my book, really. The reason I say that is that of the 2020 lockdowns, they highlighted how much energy we used as a society that was incompressible. But it also highlighted how little link there was between fossil fuel consumption and the carbon hockey stick. Like the thing just continued to increase like clockwork. It did its usual wiggle like it does every single year. And the reason for that, of course, is that it has nothing to do with it. It has actually something to do with soil. Now, I'm not the first to say that. Far from it, actually. But to the best of my knowledge, I have not found anyone who was able to explain why. So let me try to do that. The key to understand this is that tilling and harvesting both produce carbon dioxide. Now, the reason they do so is that they produce decomposition, like the fungi and the bacteria inside the soil will start decomposing plant matter, the dead plant matter, because you killed it, because you harvested, or because you killed it by tilling. And this is like an enormous amount of emissions every single year, year after year. Every spring, you can see on NASA visualizations that the plume of carbon dioxide erupt out of the Western Hemisphere and agricultural areas. And every autumn, likewise, plume of carbon dioxide that erupts all over the place. And it's basically farmers working. But at the same time, farmers have been working throughout like the past several thousand years. So that's not actually the explanation. It is important, but it's not the full explanation. I struggled for a while to explain to myself, like, why would this cause a problem now, but not in the past? And it's around that time when I came across a movie that led me to the answer. It was a movie about the unsustainability of Swedish forestry. I forget the name exactly. It was a Swedish-made movie. I'll try to find the reference for those who are interested. And what that did to me was highlight that forest clear cutting, produces an enormous amount of emissions. Now, there's a whole area of research about how much that is. And it's basically on the order of a few kilograms of carbon dioxide per square meter. Now, for those who are not good with numbers, that works out to about 10 tons of carbon dioxide per acre. Okay, so you clear a forest, get 10 tons of carbon dioxide per acre, and this stops when the canopy recovers. Okay, so once the trees are grown enough and the decomposition is going to stop eventually, but more importantly, there's plants on top that are blocking, that are soaking the soil emissions up, because it's not 10, like poof, overnight. It's a kilo per square meter a few kilos per square meter over a year, 2 years in total, right? So it's slow. Slow enough that plants can absorb it. And it turns out that thinning a forest does not produce these emissions. And that is key. And so here I was wondering, like, why is it that when you clear a forest, you get 10 tons of carbon dioxide per acre? Those go away when you thin the forest, and like, it's the emissions of a small town, right? So like, why are we not talking about this? Why are we not asking the loggers, like, please thin your forest instead of, you know, clear cutting? That would be a useful thing. And the answer is, we're not counting them. We're not counting them because of forestry map. Remember, the what justifies biomass is that on the long term, you cut the forest, grow a tree, regrow the forest, and in the long term, you have a fixed carbon stock. And so that's zero emission fuel right there, because it counts as decomposition, and because the trees regrow, then you don't need to worry about the details on the ground of what happens. But actually, that shields the realities of avoidable emissions out of you. And climate scientists usually object here that we are counting these emissions, and I will invite them to understand the difference between land use change and land use emissions, for starters. And we do count some emissions, land use emissions, like changes in carbon stock, but those two are long-term measurements that do not factor the instantaneous situation on the ground. So actually, we are not counting them. And I'd be happy to be proven wrong, but I have yet to see the documentation that says otherwise. Now, we adopted clear cutting at the turn of the 20th century. And the reason we did that was because paper. We started using paper massively with the advent of modern education at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. That produced a lot of demand for paper, and the Swedish foresters innovated at the time. I think it was the Swedish, or maybe the Germans, I don't remember, but I have a blank here. But Nordic. And so that basically corresponds to when the carbon hockey stick starts. Now, something else happens on farm fields at the same time, which is we fields, like there's an exodus that goes from the rural areas to cities, right? And as they did, they would sell fields, and they would, like, farmers would get bigger and bigger and bigger fields, and so they would rationalize their fields and they would remove the hedgerows. And at the turn of the 20th century, what they did is remove even more hedgerows to make room for tractors, right? So where in the past you would have small parcels surrounded by trees, nowadays you have huge swaths of farm fields that get tilled year after year after year. And there's a further development on farm fields, which is that there were improvements in plowing technologies in the late 19th century, which were coincidental with a move west in the United States. So that's when the farmers arrived in the Great Plains, basically. And so that allowed to plow the Great Plains at the same time. And so the Great Plains did not have hedgerows at the time, but because now you could plow them instead of having bison run and, like, graze them, then all of a sudden you have all these farming emissions that erupt at the, around the same time. So I think it's a combination of both. What the hedgerows do is three things. They, first off, it's a tree that absorbs carbon emissions from tilling and harvesting. It blocks the wind, which keeps the carbon dioxide around. And last but not least, it keeps the fungi alive, right? The fungi does not die around the hedge because the hedge keeps it alive. So once you remove the hedgerows, you basically kill the fungi as well when you till. So that leads to a straightforward way to solve the problem, right? Is to simply put the hedgerows back, and you can do that. The loggers could thin. Yeah, there are good reasons to thin, by the way. Like, trees grow faster when you thin. It's an excellent reason to do it. Maybe the loggers will not want to do that. But they could plant using alley cropping systems, right? Where you have like a row, and then a row of trees, a row of clear cut, a row of tree, and that keeps hedges, quote unquote, in the area. And the farmers could do the same. That would be the simplest way to do it. Now, I got the objection one day from someone who knew a thing or two about growing corn, which was that corn does not like shade, which is true. But alley cropping, you can have like fairly wide alleys with lots of light in the middle. So it seems to me that that's not a valid objection to my mind. Still, like, welcome one regardless. To my mind, any well-designed system that revolves around intercropping would work. So let me give you two examples. One would be, there are some regenerative farming experiments where you have farmers growing crop in between alleys of prairies, right? So they have like a two-three-yard band of native prairies, right? And then they have a band of crop, which is can be fairly large, and that allows to reintroduce local wildlife, right? The idea for them is to work with nature, to have to save habitat and to reintroduce beneficials all over the place. But to my mind, I'm fairly certain that that would work as well. And or simply to plant inside clover. Like, clover is a nitrogen fixer, and one way to get nitrogen on the field is simply plant inside of clover. You don't even need to mow the thing, just plant inside, and then you get like, and it's pretty like, very significant amount of nitrogen at that, and you don't get the same germination rate, right? But like, it's still pretty good, and then you don't need to spray fertilizer on the field, which is also not very good for them. Like, it's a salt, really. So it's unless you're using urea, it's really a salt, which is not great. So like that seems to me that land stewards could reverse this, and that could be a very good way to help the activists as well. right? Like here's how you eliminate the carbon hockey stick, is to simply manage the landscape a little bit differently, and it's really not that differently. And then we take the problem out.
Okay, so I want to ask you a question on the big picture here to make sure I understand you. That we're told that humans have increased the CO2 level from about 280 to 420. But what percent of that increase do you think was caused by burning fossil fuels?
So that's an excellent question. There was a paper which got, I forgot the name of the author. I cite him in my book. It's Kenneth something, Barrows. It was posted on Twitter by Friends of Science at around the time when I was finishing my book. And it was like, there's the number. 12% fossil fuel was the number he found. Now, the paper got all sorts of critiques. I'll give you the link so you can add it to the show notes. The paper got hammered and hammered and hammered because the authors make statements like, and therefore the carbon hockey stick is not man-made or that kind of thing, which like everyone was up in arms, like obviously. But I haven't seen anyone contradict the 12% number.
No.
And by the way, 12% is enormous. Like when I first came across the number, like the reason it caught my interest was like, hold on, because like fossil fuel compared to natural emissions, like fraction, it's like 3-5%, something like that. Like, and so I asked myself, like, how is it that it's so huge? How do we even get 12%? Like it's impossibly high, right? And I think the answer is because clearly a tailpipe, like when you drive your car, like it's going to get soaked up by the nearest tree. Like wait, when you're around a cornfield, there's nothing, no carbon dioxide around a cornfield, like hardly anything. During the peak summer, nada, zero, zero. Mm-hmm. And like within meters of it, like hardly undetectable. Plant comes by with, you know, tailpipe that gets soaked up, right? It gets soaked up. The tree in the city is going to soak up the carbon dioxide of the cars. So it's not those emissions. It's not the emissions on the ground. It has to be something higher above the canopy. And I think it comes from the industrial smokestacks. So like a coal power station or a steel plant, that kind of thing. Airplanes is another. There's no plants when your airplane is spewing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so I think that is why there is so much of it. And it lingers around a little bit longer, maybe. I don't know if the 12% number is 100% accurate. Maybe it's a bit more. Maybe I don't think it really matters. To me, the essential point is we can eliminate like the other 88% with simple land stewardship changes. So there's absolutely no reason to be fussing about fossil fuel. And if we do ever want to fuss about them, what we said earlier, like you can take the smokestack and pipe it into a hemp field, and then you soak that up too. So
okay, so yeah, so we're encouraged to believe that 100% of that increase from 280 to 420 was from fossil fuels. We're encouraged to believe that, but it might be more like 12. I want to make sure.
Yes,
out of that increase,
yes.
It might be 12, and the rest of the 88 is land use. Or do you think there's any deal where it's a lag, but after the medieval warm period, it's been 800 years, and has something to do with the lag from the warming in the past, or any other natural change? Or would it be 280 still if humans never existed over 1860?
Oh, to me, there's not a doubt in my mind that like the vast majority is attributable to topsoil loss. Like topsoil loss is a real problem, like a huge. We have 50 or so, like unless the farmers change the way they grow food, we have 50 growing seasons left or so. Something needs to change in our food systems. At minimum, they need to switch to regenerative agriculture, and that would be a welcome change. And it's an easy one. Like if there are farmers in the audience, like absolutely look into it. Like happy to organize a workshop with you guys. Like it is not a hard one. And there's some excellent podcasts that cover the topic as well, with vastly more knowledgeable people than I am. It is not a hard change. And then you depend less on inputs, you depend less on ups and downs in the marketplace, because you're probably going to be diversifying what you're producing. It is a good change. And if on top of that, we can add some trees near crops, then we also solve the carbon hockey stick problem at the same time, which would be a good thing, because it would make the climate scientists look like complete clowns, and it would turn the narrative into a dog's breakfast. But I do not think that it would stop propaganda. We need to get real about this. The fear and anger are really by design. There are some string pullers, and they are ruling by dividing and conquering, as string pullers do, and they work from behind the scene, and it's the lot of billionaires and multi-billionaires and multi-billionaires and philanthropic interests and like everyone's favorite conspiracy theory supervillains. We all know them. No need to give names here and get you in trouble. For those who are not privy with conspiracy theories, I would highly invite you actually look into them, because they are not conspiracy theories. They are very often conspiracy-like realities that you can just look up online and read the docs straight out of the horse's mouth and see for yourself that it is not what the media says. I think the part that captures my attention most was the religious aspect of it. The religious ties of nature conservancies should not be ignored. If you take the discourse of ooh, we need to protect nature, da 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 da, environmentalists, very often when you replace nature with God, you will have a good church sermon. And this is not an accident. Like every, and I really mean every conservancy, the forefathers of conservancy were all authoritarians. They were white supremacists, they were racists, they were colonialists, they were everything that the leftist activists despise and denounce, even though they are actually pursuing their work without realizing, which is a bit comical, but whatever. These are not nice people, and the authoritarianism, I like to point out that they protect nature the way they protect their daughters, so they lock her up, right, to keep other people out, and it's just they fear nature. It's very much a fear driven agenda. Authoritarianism in general is a fear driven agenda, and I think the climate agenda is probably better understood as some kind of spiritual war, and the events of the past few years, and there's this digital control grid that is being engineered around us with the digital currencies, central bank digital currencies that are being rolled out in some countries, tested in others, and that's clearly part of their agenda. There are the 5G towers and the efforts to get us chipped, really, or to at least have some kind of digital tag where you can monitor and surveil all the time. The digital surveillance grid at large is part of the same thing. The geoengineering efforts, I am lucky enough to live in an area where there is very, very little spring. But the where we lived in Hungary, the skies were covered with chemtrails, for lack of a better term, all the time. And you can tell that it's chemical in nature, because a normal contrail dissipates, I think it disappears after a minute or two. And when it lingers on for hours on end, which it does more often than not in Western countries that I've been to, then, you know, like, clearly they're spraying something in the air. What are they spraying in our skies? Geoengineering watch? Did you interview Dane Wivington yet? Or
no.
I'll have him over.
Okay.
If you want to talk about the real climate change, he's the guy.
Okay.
It's fantastic, Jeffy. There was an interview of him recently on The Last American Vagabond. For those who are interested, fantastic work he's doing. Anyway, so the geoengineering, and it seems to me that the people in charge of our clown show are engineering. Like, when you look at it from afar, we have plagues, right? We have looming food shortages because of all the chaos that the plagues have created. Now they're rolling out bird flu using PCR tests, so it's going to be the same shenanigan, and they're trying to kill the chicken pox. Using that, they're murdering millions of birds already with that. So, we're heading towards a future with very little meat except what is except bugs, basically. So, if you don't have chickens in your garden, you're probably going to be eating bugs soon enough. So, get chickens. It's a good piece of advice for those who do not have some yet. We're going to have crop failures because of the lack of fertilizer. There was a lack of fertilizer shortage last year, or this year rather. This is going to have consequences on the harvest and on next year's food availability. There have been animal feed shortages or skyrocketing prices. This is also going to have an impact. We're heading for a period of potential, maybe not famines immediately, but less food abundance, let's put it that way. I think there's still time to react as communities. Like, if we all start growing food overnight, to my mind, there's no question that we can turn this around. You can literally produce 400 kilos of food in 10 square meters. In 10 by 10 square meters. For those who doubt that, there is actually a short video of a family in Sydney by some ecological outfit. I forgot the Happen Films, I think. It's short and it's lovely. That kind of thing does exist. And we could do this in so many places, warm areas, especially colder areas. It's more difficult because you need greenhouses, but we can turn this, it's not inevitable yet that we have food shortages all over the place. If we all grow food next year, we'll be fine. If not, we're gonna have chaos and cities full of hungry people, and hungry people who have not eaten for a few days tend to behave like actual zombies. So this is not going to be a good time if those who live in cities. I mean, it's a bit of a clown show, really. And there's this thing called Project Bluebeam, which I invite find members of the audience to actually look up if they have never heard from that. That one is a fun one. It's basically the idea is let's create a new age religion of sorts, and so it's a four-step project. But the main one, it involves to use holographic displays in the skies, and to have a divine intervention of sorts. And one of the aspects of of geoengineering is a change in the ionosphere, if memory serves, which potentially allows to send radio waves inside that can interact with the brain. There's a fantastic conference by an actual military guy who explained this, which I will try to locate so that you can post it into your the show notes. It's completely mind-boggling what they are, what he says they are capable of doing. And I'm inclined to believe that he's, you know, like it's a West Point, it's a West Point talk, if memory serves me well. So like this is something that they actually teach to our military.
Okay. You know. So what are the most effective things we can do to fight the insanity, do you think?
I think we need to take back control and like take back control of our lives, take back control of our communities at every step of the way. The most important thing that we need to do, I think, is to take back control of the debate. And by that, I mean we need to stop fighting at each other. The greenies are terrified. Like they are completely demoralized. What was that former KGB agent that gave an interview where he was explaining people are demoralized. People are completely hopeless. You can present facts to them, they will not respond to facts. They're completely oblivious to reality. Like you could take them to a concentration camp and you tell them this is a concentration camp and they will say, no, this is a happiness area. They can be that brainwashed. And it's because, you know, like it's a long process. They've been preparing this for decades and decades and decades, as you explained. And this was an interview, as I recall, from the 90s. I'll find you the interview for the show notes. But the we'll get nowhere not cooperating with them. And which is why I think that the message that is in this podcast, I think is important, because there is a way to reduce fossil fuels, which actually works against the agenda of the people behind the climate narrative. It's to simply grow food in our communities and promote gardening, promote urban farming. Like, oh, you want to reduce fossil fuels? Yes, by all means. Here's how. And like, grow food. This is going to reduce your fossil and promote growing food in schools and promote, like, tell the council to create community gardens and tell the council to take back control of the communal areas and turn them into veggie patches. And let's grow fruit, like let's get rid of all of these useless trees in our cities. Like, why are we not growing trees in our cities? I kid you not, like I live in a village at the moment. There are coconut trees everywhere. Like I will not run out of food, I can guarantee you that. There are coconut trees and banana trees absolutely everywhere. Communal areas are full of food. And if you cannot afford the food, to buy food, you just go with your machete, you whack two coconuts and you have your dinner. That's it. There are eggs everywhere. The chicken, I had some chickens the other day. So we don't have chickens yet because we haven't moved into a field, but the neighbor's rooster came with a hen, and the hen for a couple of days is laying eggs into our garden. Like there are no chicken coops in the area where I live. The chickens just go as they wish, as do the dogs. There's food, and every city could look like this. Every city could be about growing food, and so they want to. They're afraid about the carbon hockey stick. Tell them how to fix it. Tell them, yeah, this is like soil-based thing actually, and here's why, and they don't count it, and this would win in court, by the way, in case there are lawyers in the audience. I am 100% sure that if we drop this into a case, we win the case, 100%, because they cannot put an explanation in front. Why do we ignore these 10 tons per acre of avoidable emissions? Like, why do we not count these things? They're avoidable, just, you know, avoid them. And so there's no reason for this policy about fossil fuels, none whatsoever. And so there's that. They're concerned about social injustice. Lots of good things happen when you are not depending on some oppressors for your food. Like if you are growing your own food and you do not want to work, you do not work. Simple as that. You have your water source because you're harvesting water from your roof. You have your heat source because you have some cuttings from, you don't need to work much after you have a functioning garden, a functioning food system around you. It's really a lot less work for money anyway. It's still a lot of work on the property, but it's less work outside of that. And more generally, we can use holistic management to create more abundance, because I think one of the key propaganda tools is giving the impression that everything is scarce, right? There's a limit of this, there's a limit of that, there's a limit of this, and there's only so much yield that you can corn here, that you can get per acre, right? But that's not true. If you remove the corn and you replace the corn with a whole bunch of other yields, you put this into an alley-poppy system, you work in three dimensions, you have, like they do here, when they grow corn, and they put a bean next to it, and they put some pepper next to it, and they put some squash, and so you have all these four crops that are growing on just on the same surface, really. They put them further apart, there's less corn yield total, but there's more yield overall. And you can do this with all sorts of production systems. And so there's no fatality unless you're using machinery to extract the maximum yield for a single crop. And that's what's actually causing the fatality. You can create far more abundance by diversifying the productions all over the place. So that's that. And so my sense is empower the activists. That's the most important part. The other is to not let ourselves disempowered by their statutes. Now, the thing to know about statutes is that they are written by the elites in a way that they do not apply for them, right? So there's always going to be an exception in the statute itself, or some kind of procedural problem in the statute that makes it so that the statute does not apply if they do not want to apply, right? And this was most obvious during the pandemic, after the injection rollout, because you had say Biden in the US, he announced mandate, but they never passed the statute. It was just a media announcement, they never passed. And then you had someone down further down the ranks who said, yeah, there's a mandate now, so let's do this. But there was no obligation for that person. So there's a procedural problem in there that could completely blows up the entire process. Another thing that they do is that they escape liability. So I don't want to get your podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go on. Yeah,
and let's move on with that. But anyway, another thing to know about the law is that law enforcers are expected to follow the law. And they are also expected to answer questions. And now cops ask questions, judges ask questions, and you and I normally answer them, but you can fit that role. You can ask questions and they are expected to actually answer and keep their cool as they answer. So you can use that against them and just incinerate everything every obligation that's thrown at you with question to completely nullify it. And you're going to end up question the facts, question the process, and you will find a problem at the end, always, because they always, 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 always produce statutes that they can ignore if they want to, always. So that's the other key point. Now, there are still people who are inside the narrative and trying to enforce things onto others, and we need to deal with those as well. So my sense is that they cannot do anything if they have no one on the ground to enforce it, right? They're completely powerless. If the cop is not enforcing the law, they are powerless. And or if the school is not enforcing this or that mandate, they are powerless. And I think the way to get compliance on that front is to simply say the truth. Like you have someone who is imposing this or that mandate or enforcing this or that law, tell everyone around them, right? Tell their wife or their husband, tell their neighbors, kids out of that, of course, tell the siblings, tell colleagues, tell places where they shop, where they go to the restaurant. Make it impossible for them to go outside without seeing disapproving stares all around them. And I do believe that would work because like no one can resist that type of pressure except a certified ghoul. And for those, just go for the lieutenants underneath them, and they will have no one to enforce their edicts as well. So I think we can take back control of our cities that way. Taking back control of judicial authority, this one is a matter of, we have a power as we the people to decide to apply the law or not as juries, right? Mm-hmm. And if a jury decides to not apply the law enough times, then you get a thing called jury annulment, which basically the judge, follow judges, then say, well, yes, the people have decided that this law no longer applies, so this law is null and void, right? We can completely smash the legal system that way. We just need to, you know, like, if you're ever part of a jury, just not guilty, whatever the case, it's okay. I mean, unless it's murder, obviously, but it, you know, just not guilty. Screw those laws. And now there is a need for justice regardless. And it seems to me that we can take back control of justice by simply organizing a citizen's justice. And now the way that would work is you take at community level, you gather an odd number of people, right? They're going to serve as the jury. They elect one president who will preside over the hearings, and the others get to decide, and the president decides with the jury if necessary. And that way you can have law without all their shenanigan. And sure, like they could be lawyers, great, like, you know, but it takes the law outside of the court system that they actually control. And a lot of judges are bought and paid for, I think. I can't prove it, obviously, but it seems to me that a lot of judges, they're not what they seem to be. Another thing is that we need to take back control of our money supply. Now, this is important because and this was obvious as well during the pandemic, a lot of rules were enforced by using the bug, like not outright robbery, but although there was a bit of that as well, I understand, but budget strings to schools, for instance. And we need to take that power out of their hands. And it seems to me that the way that we could do that is to build a parallel economy that uses local currencies. Now, local currencies, this was an experiment. There was an experiment done in the during the Great Depression, several experiments really, that worked fantastically well, and so well that they decided at the time to try to outlaw them. But like earlier points, laws do not get, like laws require law enforcement to apply them. So there's that. But it does bring up the question, what type of currency? James Corbett has an episode on that, which is very good. The only thing I'd add to his episode is food-based. It seems to me that we could make a food-based currency. Now, this is not a durable good. It's basically fiat, and anyone could issue currency, right? So like I issue a currency, like, and I think a meal is a very good currency for this because it's very relatable, right? So we could imagine the system could be digitized, by the way, where you issue currency and it's backed by your own work, which makes it de facto self-regulated, especially if there's some way to track how many currency you have issued in practice, which, you know, kind of useful. And it's inflation proof because a meal is a meal. It's not going to change over time, right? it's relatable. It, like everyone can print. It's very democratic as a result of that. And I I suspect it could work. Like, if there's someone in the audience who wants to work on like crypto, some kind of crypto thing that is Neil backed, I would love to hear from them. So I'd be curious to try working on that as well. A simple alternative is, of course, a gift-based economy, just give and take when, take later, but like give. Like the indigenous peoples do. We as a modern culture are used to, we take and then we pay, but what the way the indigenous worked is they give and then later they take, gift-based. It's a very dynamic type of economy where you basically don't count, you just give. So it depends on trust, obviously. We also need to take back control of our culture. I think, but I don't know how we do this one, to be honest. All I'd say is that our we do that at the household level, obviously, but modern talk culture, I think we can all agree is toxic. We groom fear into our kids from the earliest age, which is horrible. Like, I'm a new parent still. I mean, my daughter is 5 years old now. I am appalled by children books in general. We found some good ones, thankfully, but I was appalled. Like, it's, you know, wolf story, ghost stories, the song, it's like, oh. It's just horrifying. And it's like, seriously, my parents sang that to me as I was young. Like, what on earth were they thinking? So we try as parents to, you know, like, not breathe fear into our daughter for that reason. And so far, so good. But, you know, like, school instills fear and fear of authority and respect of authority. You're like, always be fearful if the authority is not there to lead. It's crazy. It's completely bonkers. It's like, yeah, school is not a place for children.
Okay. So I think we're reaching the wrap-up time here.
Yeah.
Major points you'd like to make here before we wrap up?
I'd like to point readers to the last chapter of my book, which discusses natural patterns. It seems to me that there is a fundamental authoritarian premise behind science itself, which permeates our mind, which is that nature is rational, and I do not believe that it is. I believe that nature works like a language, and we'll talk about this later if we have time. If not, then I would highly recommend the last chapter of my book for those who are interested. We live at the interface. Like, our mind is an interface with the world, really. And so language is what controls that, if you will. Anyway, so I think that we have a lot to learn about indigenous cultures. So their main one is to give first, take after. Another two is to take risks and let go, a bit like the, you know, Greek Stoic thing, like, what depends on you depends on you, what does not depend on you does not depend on you, and just like deal with it. Which was completely, by the way, and which says to me that they were already operating, like the storytellers, as I like to call them, were already operating at the time, because the Christian Stoics rephrase that as it was God's will, if you will, which it is not. It's just, you know, nature doing its thing. The wolf needed to eat a sheep, so he ate a sheep. Big deal. Like, you lost a sheep. There was a wolf. Yeah, okay. Shit happens. Like, protect your sheep, obviously, but, you know, like, if one goes away, that's a key teaching of, like, I can see it with the locals here. Like, the chickens, again, have no coop, none, zero. The chickens are there. And like, an animal needs to come, like a jaguar. Jaguars eat chicken. They don't come close to humans, but like, hypothetically, if a chicken goes too deep in the jungle, then it gets eaten. It happens. Or sometimes a dog catches one. I think the key message I have is philosophical, if you will, is that what I found most fascinating as I was learning how to grow food was how much discovering how much societies look like their food systems. That it came as a shocker to me, because I had such like I had studied social science, but I had never come across that message. Like if I had been told in my early 20s that like a city is a CAFO, like concentrated animal feeding operation, I'd have gone, yep, that is actually right. And that is actually right. That is what our cities are. They are concentrated food, animal feeding operations and exploitative food operations at that. And the dystopia where we're heading is like, you know, like the Chinese pig factories, multi-stories with pigs, AI driven, or they're tagged all the way across, rationed and what have you. That's our future if we don't react. So let's do something about it. Anyway, ways to help out. Just to wrap up, please circulate this message. Especially among experts, media voices, I'd be especially keen if someone can circulate it among fossil fuel interest, because I would love to be participating in trying to smash the propaganda in court with them. But also local groups that can actually take action, so councils, farmers, bloggers, gardening clubs, and things like that. It seems to me that we need to get the word out. Let's empower the activists. Like let's turn the like completely demoralized masses against their manipulators. I think that will work. I really do think it will work. And if there are scientists in the audience who want to write peer review article based on what I've been discussing in this chat, by all means, get in touch. I do not think that it will change a thing, but like, let's get those papers out because my work has not been peer reviewed. I don't care about peer review, especially. But like some people, they only read peer review papers, so let's put them something in front of them. I'd be especially interested in a study that measures the difference in carbon dioxide between an alley cropping system and a open field system, because that paper, to my mind, and we could do that one in the spring when farmers are tilling, because there are alley cropping systems that exist already. And so we could just like, you know, take the measurement and by next spring, we could have the question settled and the paper out by summer probably and peer reviewed. And that would be a, I think a bombshell paper. Maybe there are papers that actually exist on that topic already for all I know, like, but let's highlight them. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, I haven't even looked into the literature. Most importantly of all, like, please deliver this message yourself. Like, I'm just the messenger, but like, this message is what matters. Like, I can deliver this message. Anyone who can read can deliver this message. Just like, you know, it's accounting fraud. It's not rocket science. It's accounting fraud. We just need to highlight this is accounting fraud, and keep repeating it until people get hold on. Yeah. This is accounting fraud. And in court, they cannot escape by saying, oh, you're not an expert. But like, in court, you show the accounting fraud for what it is. And there's no escaping that they can do, because it is an accounting fraud at the end. So we just need to highlight the fraud. And I mean, I'm happy to deliver this message myself, but I think other people can deliver this message too. So I highly encourage anyone who can do so to actually do so. For my own efforts, look, if anyone is interested in joining the regenerative movement and interested in some kind of workshop, happy to do one. There are lots of workshops already by permaculture experts, regen ag experts, lots of resources on ag and permaculture, mm-hmm. soil science, tons of stuff. It can be a bit overwhelming. It seems to me that there might be a need for some like hands-on crash course, if you will, 1-2 hours. If you have any interest in this, please subscribe to my Substack and write me. My email is on my website. It's easy to find. It's DDEBERNARDY@protonmail.com. So, email your thoughts and what you would like to see in a workshop. It seems to me that the most practical thing to be teaching to newcomers in the field would be how to grow potatoes in the garden, how to make your own fertilizer, how to have healthy plants in general, how to select plants so that they work together, that type of thing. So if there's interest in that, I can keep it short in 1 hour, 2 hour sessions that can make it very practical and functional. Happy to do that. Would love to work in that actually, and turn that into my full-time job. For the rest, I could use some financial support at the moment. So if there are some lovely backers, please get in touch. Also remote work opportunities, especially interested in court cases, as I said, also interested in regenerative work, like counsel that needs help, farmer that needs help, loggers that needs a piece of advice, or like landowner who wants to start a big garden or something, can do that too, like hands-on. For the rest, management consulting, I can do that too. So for those who are potentially interested, I used to run a marketing and sales team. It was my last job. So I can give good advice on those things as well. And I think that's it.
Okay. Very good. You brought up a lot of things, a lot of facts I have not heard before. So thank you for doing that. And I'll get this published pretty soon. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You're most welcome. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for helping me get this message out. It's really like, I released my book like a couple months ago, and it was a soft release out of necessity because we were fleeing the Ukraine war at the time. So we moved from, we didn't want to stay in Hungary, so we moved to Mexico. And so it was really a soft launch, and this is the de facto launch of my book for all practical intents, really. So yeah, the book is short, by the way, and for those who want to read it, 30,000 words or so, like, really, really short. It's on my Substack. Anyone can read it. I didn't want to make it a paid for book because I think the information in it is, it matters more that the information is out and people buy the book. For those who want to buy it, like, please. But the other, it needs to get out. So we need to stop this down, shall we?
Okay.
I hope we will. I know we will. Deep inside me, I'm sure we have already won. And I think they know it. They are just laughing at us at the moment. They're just trolling us with their media stories. Like, the lunacy of the media stories that we are fed day in, day out. It's just trolling at this point. Like, who the hell still believes anything they say? Seriously.
But you think they know they have lost?
Yes, I think so.
Good. All right. So on that note.
Yeah.
let's go ahead and wrap up. But thank you very much. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay. Ciao, ciao.